Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Marigold Clothing, making fashion fun since 1989, in Broad Ripple, featuring women's clothing, gifts, and accessories, and committed to customer service. More on Facebook or at marigoldclothing.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD 2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are talking about Indiana's bicentennial, new inspiration for a very old inn, and the backstory of a successful new restaurant. First, we'll talk with City Market vendor Kara Daffhorn of You Relish Farm about her work in history and local food, and about her efforts to celebrate the state's bicentennial at the Indianapolis City Market. We'll also hear from Jacob Ebel, who with his wife Kate are new partners at the Story Inn in Brown County, Indiana. Jacob fills us in on their plans for the historic inn and restaurant. And we'll also talk with Chef Danny Salgado of Reverie Restaurant in Greenwood about how he and co-owner Chef Mark Hendricks have launched a successful independent restaurant on the South Side. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Food community has so many aspects. Of course, there are the chefs who are in the spotlight and the new restaurants that make headlines, but there are also the farmers and the entrepreneurs, the small businesses that are working to bring local food to a wider audience, people who are excited about what the city has to offer and who want to help grow the local food culture. Kara Daffhorn is in that category. As a City Market vendor, she operates You Relish Farm and sells her crockpot ready meals, but she's also an advocate for Indiana and is involved in its bicentennial activities. I stopped by the historic Indianapolis City Market recently to talk with Kara about her efforts to bring history to life and how it ties together with local food and You Relish Farm.
I've been a historical reenactor with Mid-States Living History Association for the last 8 years. We travel 5 states. And we perform at places like the Lew Wallace Museum and Study Center. And our main goal is to bring history to life in an immersive experience for families.
Now, what era is that?
1863 to 1865 is what we portray. Our story centers around Lew Wallace, and my persona is Anna Plunk, who received a honorary lieutenancy from General Lew Wallace for her service as a spy.
During the Civil War?
During the Civil War. She was a Union spy, and she would bring information on her horse and carriage because her sons were in his battalion. So she would disguise herself by bringing jams and jellies and food and herbs. So my story centers around permaculture, which is something that's important as a kitchen pottinger. And she would bring herbs to the hospital steward. So our organization represents the medical history of the Civil War. So we have a fully operating hospital tent. And a lady of charity like Anna Plunk would bring her herbs as medicine. So she would bring a nosegay that would contain things like lavender, sage, lemon balm, mint. She mainly kept that close to her nose because of the rancor and odoriferous odors coming out of the hospital. She might also bring more scandalous things like whiskey and dice, and all disguised in a hollowed-out Bible so she wouldn't be caught by the general.
And she was also delivering information, right?
Correct. So she would bring information like which fields still had crops in them because she would be coming from Tennessee. So she was able to tell Lew Wallace what burnt bridges there were or battalions coming from the Confederate soldiers. She would also organize other women such as a ladies group. They called it the Ladies Aid Society. It came out of Iowa. And she would bring things like conserves or preserves. She would also bring mittens and socks and wools to help the soldiers recover in the hospital tent.
So you portray all of this in your spare time, right?
In my spare time.
But then you also have the stand at the city market where people might be familiar with you. So tell me how that came about and how maybe it all ties together somehow, because I'm kind of guessing it does.
It all comes together. We had a Dutch oven in 1863. And the recipes that I have at City Market at U Relish Farm are traditional from the period of 1863. We've always been eating beans and legumes and peas. And some of them have funny names like Bubbles and Squeak, which was a traditional recipe of ham and potatoes and beans that would have been cooked as a modest supper. Supper in that time period happened at 4 o'clock, and it was meant to be a modest meal to sup upon. And so historically, I provide those same opportunities to sup upon utilizing a more contemporary appliance called the crock pot.
So I think that's very interesting, the progression from the Dutch oven being cooked over an open fire to our crock pots, which of course are incredibly convenient. So that's kind of a neat progression. How does your history background come into play?
Well, contemporarily, we are looking at beans as a dry commodity, which made them easy to travel. It means that you don't have to put them in refrigeration. It's a traditional dry good of a mercantile of both 1863 and today. We use a permaculture agricultural method, which would have been used in 1863. Spices like thyme, sage, marjoram, and some that haven't been heard of, like lovage. Lovage is a celery alternative and was grown in the gardens of that time period. And I came to be aware of that through my research at the Marion County Public Library.
So this is all very fascinating, how you've tied together history and food and a business. So tell me about the business a little bit more that's here at the City Market.
We incorporated in August of 2010 with the mission to maximize people's dollars using the slow cooker. I came from IU School of Medicine, and I read data that said if people crock pot, they won't go through the drive-through line 98% of the time. And so I've spent a decade of my life creating flavors that can be just poured in and add water, broth, or beer. And this gives people the opportunity of having healthy, nutrient-dense, preservative-free food and not go through the drive-through line.
So tell me about your products. They are pretty much just ready to pour in the crock pot, right?
Everything is shelf stable with a long shelf life, and simply you just add a liquid.
What kind of things result from that? Are they soups, stews,
let's call them like that? Stoops. A stew soup. They're thick by nature because I want you to put them over rice. I want you to chill them and put them over salad. So you have the opportunity to eat a hot meal that's comfort food or a super simple supper for summer.
So that brings up a good point that the crock pot is not just for hearty winter foods, you know, where you come in from the cold and you smell the wonderful crock pot. You can do other things as well.
Well, I'd like to think that we don't have to heat up our kitchen. We can keep the kitchen cool with the use of the crock pot. I probably could preach that till my dying day, but truth is that fall to winter is our best season because we're looking for warm, comfort food. But crock pots can travel. So if you're going to your next pitch-in or potluck and you want to take something easy, this is an easy way to keep food on a relatively warm level and safe.
Tell me some of the meals that are available at the stand at the City Market.
We've developed 39 flavors. Some of them failed at the beginning, but now we have some super sellers. White bean rosemary is by far the most popular. I think that's because of Senator Capehart, who was a senator in our great state of Indiana, and he fashioned that the northern bean, which was named because of the Civil War, the northern bean, and the navy bean because of Lieutenant William B. Cushing, who came across the Ohio River and fought General John Hunt Morgan, that stakey southern sympathizer. And so we have great names from the Civil War of these legumes that we traditionally eat. They're not just the white bean. They're the northern bean. And so we can celebrate history just with a simple sack to put in our crock pot.
We've been talking with Indianapolis City Market vendor Kara Daffhorn of You Relish Farm. We'll be back with more from Kara here on WFYI and WFYI.org. The celebration of Indiana's bicentennial is going on all year and includes all sorts of events, but one local food entrepreneur wanted to make sure that Indiana's agricultural history at the Indianapolis City Market was documented as well. City Market vendor Kara Daffhorn of You Relish Farm created the Bicentennial Bazaar to showcase local farmers and chefs and to provide a way for families to explore the market. She's also created an Indiana farm food road trip along US 40 to promote agritourism as well. Kara explains her efforts to bring the Bicentennial Bazaar to the city market and her work to promote agritourism along US 40.
The Bicentennial is a celebration that is statewide, and I was more than happy to celebrate history as it was, is, and can be in the historic Hall of Agriculture. The city market has been created in 1821 for the purposes of farmers, and I wanted to make sure that that was represented in the Indiana State Archives. So I've invited farmers to participate in our Bicentennial Bazaar and offer an honest-to-goodness farmers market here in the city market.
Obviously, the city market, you know, it's a very historic building, so it seems like a natural for something like this. How does it work? Where is the bazaar located in, and what is it? Is it a farmer's market? Tell me a little bit more about it.
We have three components to the Bicentennial Bazaar. The first and most important is that this is a family-friendly destination. So we're offering families an opportunity to picnic on the mezzanine in the winter and the early spring when the weather's not so suitable to picnic outside. And we're giving families the opportunity to name the bear in the chair.
Okay, now what is that?
We wanted to document history for the Indiana State Archives, and one of our opportunities for family free fun is to name the bear in the chair. It's simply a stuffed bear that kids can hug and touch and name, and our goal there is to celebrate families. Another component to the Bicentennial Bazaar is the Chef Showcase, where local chefs from around central Indiana have come together to utilize the food from the farmers market in cuisine that they develop on the spot. We've had an overwhelming response of chefs. Each week we feature a new chef at the Clark's Demonstration Appliance Kitchen, and they incorporate food from our farmers at the Bicentennial Bazaar in their cuisine, which is sampled free of charge to our public audience.
Well, now that's very fun. It's nice to come cook in the kitchen here at the city market. So what sorts of things have they made?
Chef Andrew Whitmoyer was our last presenter. He works at Thunderbird and was also my executive chef for You Relish Farm. He featured a pork rind with pork. He did a double pork on pork with pimento cheese and then used the collard microgreens from the Super Microgreens company. Say Cheese, who was here 3 weeks ago, Shanna Balinski is a chef and our newest chef at City Market, and she demonstrated how to make mozzarella and ricotta. And so she taught the general public how to make mozzarella out of rennet and citric acid, which was a great example of learning. We had a chef fly all the way in from Alaska, Kathy Jones, who used to be a tenant here at the market, to show up to make steak and eggs, which was provided by the farmers of the local market and featured here at the Clark's Appliance Demonstration Kitchen.
Now, how does this all tie in with the bigger picture of the Bicentennial of the state?
We are happy to raise the flag and the attention of the celebration of the state. And by doing so, we filed an application which gave us the official endorsement legacy project, which means that we have the opportunity to advertise statewide. And so to further those efforts, we developed a farm food road trip along the old National Road, or US 40.
Washington Street.
Washington Street, which is really right here at City Market. So by celebrating the bicentennial, we reflect upon our history and realize that agriculture was moved between Washington, D.C. and Indianapolis, who are directly correlated architecturally as cities. Thomas Jefferson actually funded the old US 40, or the National Road, for the purposes of bringing products from Indiana, which was considered the frontier at that time, to Washington, D.C. So the old National Road was taking agricultural products to and from what was the frontier, Indiana, to the capital city. And it was created with the first federally made tax. It was the first national highway. We have two maps that are available at urelish.com. The first map celebrates the orchards along US 40 and documents orchards like Tuttle Orchery and Distiller Orchard so that you can travel and see the farms along US 40. And US 40 in Indiana went from Greenfield to Terre Haute. It was the way to make things straight in a crooked path, is how the centennial marked it. The second map details farmers' markets along US 40, again between Greenfield and Terre Haute, so that you can plan your road trip with your family, kids in the back seat, along a farmer market path and enjoy them throughout the weekend.
So now tell me, who is coming to the Bicentennial Bazaar here at the City Market? You've been seeing, you know, maybe some different crowds than usual?
We have. Specifically, we're seeing a regional visitor who's coming for the bicentennial year to celebrate with us. We're seeing family populations. We're seeing slow walking, interesting out-of-towners as far as Evansville to Fort Wayne participating in the farm food road trip.
You getting to chit-chat a little bit with the newcomers?
Well, luckily, I'm the owner and operator at my booth, and I consider myself a beacon for the bicentennial, shining the light upon the historic hall. So certainly, I am an extrovert and enjoy all the people of the market, and I'm really pleased to see that the City Market's revitalization and drawing people from the region.
Now, tell me just a little bit about the farmer's market that takes place, the Bicentennial Bazaar, the farmer's market aspect of that, because people might be familiar with the Indy Winter Farmer's Market that was here, which has moved to a new location.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So our farmer's market is a dozen strong. We have winter products, as you could expect. So these are farm products that have been created through the summer, and now we are receiving the harvest in the winter. So you'll find things like bee pollen and organic popcorn. You're going to find meat such as summer sausage and jerky. We have microgreens available, and we have an orchard coming from Madison County. And we also have jams, jellies, spices. We have a new chai tea vendor from Indiana, originally from India, which has been exciting to see how he's using herbs and spices that are grown locally and put into chai, which has been fabulous.
Also, there are events coming up for St. Patrick's Day, right?
We want to emphasize that this is a safe place to bring families. Because of that, this is my 6th annual St. Patrick's Day with a little luck children's scavenger hunt, where we search for the shamrocks. 19 vendors are participating in this activity, and children who can read and those who cannot all can participate in this free activity. At the end of the activity, a sideshow has offered free face painting for children, and then they get a non-food prize for their participation in the scavenger hunt.
Now, when does that take place?
It takes place on Thursday, March 17th, between 10 and 3, before or after the parade. We'd really like you to come visit us at City Market.
We've been talking with Kara Daffhorn of Urelish Farm about Indiana's bicentennial and how local food and farmers are playing a part in the celebration. For more information on the Bicentennial Bazaar and Indiana's farm food on US 40, go to urelish.com. Brown County is one of my favorite places in Indiana. As I mentioned on last week's show, I was at the Abe Martin Lodge at Brown County State Park last weekend to help judge the food competition at the National Maple Syrup Festival. While I was there, I got the chance to talk with Jacob and Kate Ebel, a young couple who are now partners with owner Rick Hofstetter of The Story Inn. Now, The Story Inn is a favorite of many, many people, and not just in Indiana. The inn now encompasses what was the entire town of Story, and its well-regarded restaurant has been operating, pretty much in the middle of nowhere, for decades. I was excited to hear about Jacob and Kate's plans for the Story Inn. It's one of my favorite places to go for a road trip. And thousands of visitors descend upon Story for the Indiana Wine Fair in April. Jacob tells us how he became involved with the Story Inn and what he and Kate have planned for the historic destination.
Well, my involvement goes back, like I said, about 10 years ago. I worked as a sous chef there after culinary school, and then I left to pursue my career as a chef working around the country. And then about 8 months ago, my wife Kate and I, after getting married, had the opportunity to come back and work as a general manager and sales director, and then I had the opportunity to partner with the past sole proprietor, Rick Hofstetter, in January. So now we're back and working to build a team. We have a great new chef, a great new wine director, and a gardener that's been there for a little while and really working to grow the food and beverage culture and, you know, sustainability mission that Story's been on for a while, but really, you know, champion that into the future.
What sort of things do you have in mind? Do you see changes coming for Story? Because, I mean, it's been people, you know, have very fond feelings for Story Inn.
I wouldn't say, you know, bad changes. Some changes to, you know, progress it into, I guess, the future of, you know, hospitality. And we really want to raise the bar, continue to raise the bar with what we're doing. I know Story, there's an expectation there when people come for a, you know, fine dining experience and, you know, a you know, hospitable experience. We want to work to enhance that, build upon that, create a higher level of consistency than I think may have been there over the past few years, and just expand it, like I said, to another level, but we're also doing things like expanding our gardens. We're doubling them in size. We're, you know, creating new menus, working with new local partners that include not just wineries, which we've always done, but breweries as well. We started doing monthly brewer dinners that gain a lot of traction in, and just, you know, expand, you know, as a whole, the operation. And like I said, that includes reaching out to the local community and working with new partners.
Now tell me a little bit about the gardening, because that's been kind of a big deal. There's you tend to use a lot of things that you grow right there on site too.
Yeah, we do, and unfortunately a lot of people don't know that yet, and so that's something we really want to try to promote. We've had gardens on Story for, you know, at least 10 years since I last cooked there, but they've grown quite a bit, and like I said, this year we're doubling them. We've got a few new hoop houses. We're putting in a pumpkin patch on our horse pasture, which is really cool. Our gardener, Jackie, well, her and her husband, Pete, that maintain the grounds and the gardens, they've been with us for a couple years, done an amazing job. And, you know, Jackie's brought her family's own varieties of heirloom seeds. So we do everything from heirloom tomatoes. We're planting corn this year, pea shoots, microgreens, different types of lettuces and cabbages, peppers. It's great.
Now, that seems like a lot, but you do have some space there in Story, right?
We have quite a bit of space, actually, and that's another thing people may not realize. We have about 18 acres of property there, so the gardens right now consume maybe about half an acre. Like I said, we're looking to double that. We have horse pastures, a field that holds up to 6,000 people behind the inn. That's where we do our Hoosier Hops and Harvest Festival, the Indiana Wine Fair, and the majority of our weddings back there, so a lot of space.
Now, the wine fair is always at the end of April, so that's coming up.
It is. April 30th this year. Well, April 30th every year. It's in its 14th year. We work with them. We've got about 40 local wineries participating, so it's had a tremendous amount of growth over the past 14 years. We've already almost doubled ticket sales online from last year, so it's great. And hopefully we can continue to accommodate that many people. We've got some great music. Indiana Boys and a couple other bands, so local musicians, local wine. We'll have food there, which, you know, obviously we source our food locally if we don't grow it, so it'll be a great event.
Now, it is a big event. How many people do you typically expect?
Between 3,000 and 6,000.
Okay. Now, that seems huge for a very out-of-the-way place in the middle of Brown County.
Yeah, it certainly is. Like I said, it's gained so much traction over the past 14 years, so it's had some time, certainly, to gain notoriety, and it certainly wasn't that big its first year, but it is the original wine festival in the state, and it's also the largest in the state. So,
now, how many wineries do you typically expect?
About 40 this year. Between 30 and 40 is typical, but I think the amount's grown in the state as well, like the microbreweries. But we expect about 40 this year.
You do have a brewing festival in the fall, right? Hops and Harvest, yep. Is that it?
It's called the Hoosier Hops and Harvest Festival, and that is the second weekend of September. And again, that's grown tremendously. That's in its seventh year this year. And again, about 30 breweries, local music and food. And one thing I should note, which is it's positive for both our guests and our brewers, is the Indiana laws have changed a little bit. So the brewers will be able to sell their beer at the festival this year. So that's something we want to let people know. It's, you can do more than just sample. If you like something, you can actually take it home with you, which hasn't been done in the past.
Now, tell me a little bit about how you see the food going at Story Inn, because it has always had a very high reputation.
I agree. We have a new chef there. His name's Eric Swanson. He lives in Bloomington, and he's done tremendous work. And we understand being in Brown County, there's some expectations with local staples in Nashville. However, we want to set ourselves apart from what's being done in Nashville and make it worth the drive for people that want a unique dining experience. If we can't grow the food on property, raise it on property, it's from Indiana. We use Fisher Farms, Viking Farms, Cook Family Farms. Everything's fresh, and menu changes weekly. So that's something, semi-new and exciting that Chef Eric brings to the table. Like I said, the beer dinners, the wine dinners, there's always something new happening. You won't get the same meal one week after another.
We've been talking with Jacob Ebel of the Story Inn in Brown County, Indiana. For more information on the inn and restaurant, go to storyinn.com. I talked with Jacob Ebel of the Story Inn last week during the National Maple Syrup Festival, but syrup-making festivities in Indiana are continuing this week as well. The sap is definitely flowing in Indiana, and even though it's not officially spring yet, maple trees are being tapped. It doesn't take much of a warm-up to make that happen. In fact, all it takes are days when the temperature stays above freezing and nights when the temperature falls again to start the sap flowing in sugar maple trees. And those trees are all around us. You know the ones, big leaves and those whirligig seeds that twirl down each year? They are all around, which isn't surprising when you consider that Indiana is part of the United States maple syrup belt. That maple belt stretches down from Maine into Ohio and Indiana and back up into Wisconsin, covering 10 states and several Canadian provinces. And Indiana is the southernmost and westernmost state where maple syrup is made, which means that spring happens here first. The days warm up, and the sap starts flowing in our sugar maple trees well before it does in trees in those top syrup-producing areas in Vermont or Canada. So you can get out and explore syrup making in Indiana right now. This is Indiana's first Maple Weekend. A dozen Indiana syrup producers around the state will be participating with open houses so visitors can see the syrup-making process up close. For example, Rutherford Sugar Camp, located between Newcastle and Muncie, will be bottling and offering tours of the sugar bush. That's the woods where taps and tubing are in place so you can see how the sap gets to the sugar house. For more information on Indiana's Maple Syrup Weekend, look for it on Facebook. Like to hear about chefs these days. We see them on TV and in the kitchens of our favorite restaurants, and we follow along with their projects and, of course, follow them on social media as well. So I was happy to catch up with a chef who last year opened a cool new restaurant in Greenwood, Indiana. Chef Danny Salgado opened Reverie Restaurant with business partner and co-executive chef Mark Henricks in Old Town Greenwood. The restaurant has proved to be a success, and we'll hear more about that later in today's program. But I wanted to hear a chef's backstory as well. Danny tells us where he's from, where he's cooked, and how he knew at age 16 that he wanted to be a chef.
Well, I'm from Chicago, Illinois. I grew up in Crystal Lake. I went to Elgin Community College Cooking School. And one of my chef instructors said that, you know, I should probably go to CIA if I could afford it. And I had a buddy that was actually going there, too. So him and I both went to CIA together. I interned at the Scottsdale Princess. I worked at Charlie Trotter's. I've worked at Marriott Gaslamp Hotel, Caesar's Palace, Signature Room, The Gage, 312 in Chicago.
Well, I'm sure everybody asks, what was it like working at Trotter's? What was, you know, was it like what we hear and what we imagine?
The stories are true. The stories are very true. And it was nice to go and do that for a year, you know, and that's really kind of what set my career path.
What was it like there? And we hear, you know, how intense, you know, he was. What were you doing there?
I was working the fish station, and it was very, you know, everyone tried to be better than everyone else. So it was a real professional, fast-paced, you know, really intense atmosphere.
So if you're peeling something, you're really, you know, you're focused
really
on that.
You're really peeling.
You know, did you know then that this was what you were going to keep doing?
I knew I was going to keep doing it when I was 16.
Did you really? Now, how does a kid know that?
Because my first job was, I've always worked in kitchens. My first job was a busboy, then I was a dishwasher, then I was a line cook, and then I worked, before I went to CIA, I worked at a fine dining restaurant called 1776 in Crystal Lake, and he was actually a Charlie Trotter alumni, and he went to CIA, so he kind of pushed me in both ways.
Now, we hear a lot of people giving advice to kids who, you know, they see chefs on TV and they want to be a chef, and they always tell them, you better work for a while and see if you really want to go to culinary school. Do you go with that kind of advice?
I completely agree, because it's not a lifestyle for everyone. You know, what you see on TV and what we actually do is night and day.
Now, how so? Explain that a little bit, because, chefs are, you know, they're kind of held up and idolized. You know, they're rock stars now. So why isn't it what people imagine?
They don't get the long hours. They don't get the stress. They don't get, you know, just everything that goes into one single day, you know, and it's not easy. Dishwasher called in sick. The hot water heater's broken. Your delivery's late for lunch. You know, there's a lot of factors that go into a single day.
What would a regular day be for someone who's cooking on the line? Someone, you know, like where, all the places that you've been, what's kind of a regular day?
Normally, so let's say a night line cook comes in, gets their mise en place together. They have to set up their station, make sure everything's ready, you know, by 4:35 o'clock when we open. Go through service, you know, go through, you know, 3-4 hours of straight cooking, and then it's the cleanup, you know, and making sure everything's put away, everything's labeled, dated, wrapped. Then sweep, mop the floors, clean the fryers, organize the walk-in, you know, and whatever prep you want to do for the next day, because you're not going to come in early, because we're not going to pay you, so you better get it done the night before.
I think you're right. I think those are the sorts of things that people don't see. When they see all the fancy cooking on TV, they don't see the cleaning, for example.
They don't see the cleaning, the peeling potatoes. They don't see putting, you know, 100-piece orders away, you know, having to organize the kitchen pretty much every day. You know, making sure, because if you don't stay on top of it, you're going to have a dirty kitchen.
Well, and like you said, the dishwasher calls in. Someone has to wash the dishes, right?
Yep, and everyone here at our restaurant has washed dishes. Everyone, every cook, you know, myself, Mark. So we're not too good to do anything here.
So how do you get from, you know, the 16-year-old kid who knows he's going to go into this to where you are now, where you own your own restaurant and had a very successful first year? Are there steps along the way that you can identify that were key?
You got to keep your head down. Yes, chef. Do whatever you're told. Do it fast, and continue on to new projects. Always trying to stay ahead and working hard. I mean, when you stand around and joke around, those people, they'll just never get it.
Now, how do you do that? I mean, this must be a real passion because, you know, you've talked about the long hours and you know, pay isn't great in this business, you know, and then finding time to push yourself to read, to, you know, work harder. That, how do you fit it all in?
You have to. You just do. There's no real, you know, we read when we can. You know, we just, I don't know. I don't know how I do it.
So talk a little bit more about the progression of some of the places that you've worked and how that sort of led to coming here in Greenwood, Indiana.
I think my first sous chef job, I was 21, and it's just always been that way. You know, I've worked the line a couple times as a line cook in my career, but it's mostly been sous chef since I was 21, executive chef at 24, I think, and it's just always been that way.
So for people who maybe, you know, don't know the difference between some of the roles in the kitchen, kind of go through that. So what is the sous chef position, you know, and how does it differ from things like the line cook or the executive chef?
The sous chef is pretty much ultimately responsible for the kitchen. They have to be able to do everything. They have to know everything that's going on. They pretty much run the kitchen. The chef, you know, here we have it set up differently just because we always have, you know, to where I work the line or I'll expedite, but normally I work saute. Sous chef's normally on grill, and then we have, you know, our other cooks that work hot appetizers, pantry, and then we have one student actually that's at night that kind of does whatever we ask him to do.
It kind of seems like it's been a natural progression for you, mm-hmm. you know, from knowing what you wanted to where you are now.
Yeah, I would say so.
Has there been certain things along the way, you know, that have been, I don't know, challenges or things that were, you know, especially terrific along the way, some specific, you know, gigs that you particularly liked, you know, that kind of built on where you were going?
I liked living in Vegas. That was cool. You know, being in a banquet kitchen that size and seeing the amount of food that would go out, you know, really taught me to handle volume. You know, so when I went to the Marriott Gaslamp Hotel, I ran their whole banquet program, and it was really neat. We'd cater for, you know, actors and stuff like that, baseball teams, because we're right next to Petco Park. So it's cool.
But then what leads you to want to have your own place?
Not being told what to do anymore and being able to do what we want to do.
So now before Greenwood and before Reverie, where were you? How did you end up in Indiana?
Well, Mark called me. Mark moved out here to run Mesh on Mass Ave. And he asked me if I wanted to come out and do the Mesh in Louisville. So I moved out here and I was his sous chef for 6 months. Then I took over the exec chef role, and then we decided to do a place in January.
When you say you decided to do a place, how do you do that? How do you decide to do a place?
It was just kind of like a decision. You know, Mark called me up and said he wanted to go back to work, but he didn't want to work for anyone, and we figured we could both do it together. We've worked, you know, not too many places have two executive chefs that work well together in the kitchen, and him and I work very well together.
We've been talking with Chef Danny Salgado of Reverie Restaurant in Greenwood. We'll be back with more from Danny here on WFYI and WFYI.org. It's always encouraging to hear about a local independent chef-driven restaurant that's doing well. And that's what I got to hear when I stopped by Reverie Restaurant recently in Greenwood, Indiana. I got to talk with Chef Danny Salgado, who along with Chef Mark Hendricks opened Reverie about a year and a half ago. They opened Reverie in the middle of Old Town Greenwood, at the corner of Main Street and Madison Avenue, in a historic building that held some surprises during renovation. But there have been some surprises, too, from the local clientele. The community has embraced the chef-driven restaurant in a way that may have been surprising to some. Many thought that the South Side wouldn't go for the kind of menu the chefs had in mind, but that's not what happened. Danny tells us how the restaurant took shape
and how a couple of chefs from Chicago have brought a creative menu to Old Town Greenwood.
Mark came up with the name Reverie, which means daydreamer. He's always been a daydreamer as a kid. Then we took over the space, and we kind of just, we were here every day. We'd sit in this building for 8 hours a day, sometimes with no lights, staring at walls, waiting for construction to happen, trying to figure out what we were going to do. We had menus written, order guides written before they even started construction. We were just fascinated to see the progression of, this used to be an old law office, so there was all, you know, a bunch of offices, and we didn't have a measuring tape, so we'd measure with, you know, by with our feet, you know, where we're going to put the bar, where the kitchen's going to go, how this is going to look, and it was an amazing journey.
Now, it's a historic building, so that I'm sure that causes a lot of challenges, but it's very cool too. So tell me how you settled on the building and kind of its background.
We found the building, you know, it went up for lease, I think, in February, March of 2014. And when we saw the space, we loved it. When we found out that it was all exposed brick and we were able to kind of tear it apart and bring it back to its original glory, we were really excited.
Now, what year was it built in?
1861. Wow. So when we started construction, we found a hidden cellar where we found, it's called a 1910 Businessman's Paper Press. It's pretty much just a paper compactor. We found this hidden cellar. They had to rezone the building because nobody knew it was there. So we found a bunch of medicine bottles, a bunch of beer bottles from, I would say, mid-1900s. So we're guessing that they ran some liquor out of here as well.
So you have this beautiful old building, but you had to bring it back into shape for a restaurant. So how did you go about doing that? Did you know what you wanted it to be when you first saw it, or was it a progression?
It was a progression because we didn't know, you know, what was underneath the shag green carpet. And we were able to find original hardwood that we were able to use. We actually found a rake. A rake was just a rake in the building. And we ended up taking it and hitting the walls and pulling out the drywall and then pulling out the insulation to see if we were going to be able to do the exposed brick. And that rake now is at our host stand hanging on the wall.
How do you create the atmosphere? I mean, other than the fact that it's a beautiful historic building, what was your vision for what the restaurant was going to feel like? Because, you know, that atmosphere is a very important thing, you know, from the diner's perspective.
Well, we looked at it from, you know, we got a bunch of barn wood from his father's milk parlor, and that we envisioned like a rustic kind of feel, and, you know, I love whiskey, so we decided to go with, you know, a plethora of different whiskeys, and then even the Johnny Cash and outlaw kind of country music, you know, it's kind of become our little theme over here, and it was a progression, you know. It was a lot of being in the building during construction, and, you know, and kind of overseeing every single thing that was done to this building.
Did your vision materialize? You know, what you had in your heads, did that come about?
It did. And we're very proud of what we've done here.
Well, talk a little bit about being in Greenwood and maybe some of the challenges there, because, you know, Greenwood perhaps has a reputation for not being particularly adventuresome. And I'm guessing that you're both adventurous chefs.
We have been, and we're a family restaurant, so we do have, you know, signature or classic things on the menu that, you know, everyone knows. And then there's some off-the-wall things that we do. We do sweetbreads. We sell the most foie gras we've ever sold.
Okay, now that's interesting right there. So both of those, you know, foie gras, you know, is it luxury ingredient? You know, something you don't really expect? You know, sweetbreads are a little challenging maybe. How does that work?
I think it's the education of the servers, and, you know, people down here, they like to go out to eat and they like good food. So us being, you know, one of the few independent restaurants and offering things that are off the beaten path, you know, people are really receptive to it down here.
Were you surprised?
We were very surprised. Very surprised because we didn't know. We didn't know. Both of us are from Chicago. You know, we both lived in Indiana for a year. And now coming down to Greenwood, we had no idea. We had no idea what we'd sell down here.
What was the opening menu like? Does it change regularly?
We change it once every 2 weeks. We'll change like 4 or 5 items out and put new stuff on. And, you know, there's a couple things that have stayed. We've always had foie gras on the menu. Always had the veal and wild mushroom meatloaf and the short rib.
Now, why is that? And why do you think that those do so well?
They just sell. You know, people know what meatloaf is, and we do a twist, you know, with ground veal, and then we puree veal liver into it, and then ground wild mushrooms, and then wrap the whole thing in caul fat, slow cook it, and it's just, it's so good.
So maybe we have underestimated the dining public on the south side. You know, it gets a bad rap. It honestly does, for whatever reason. So it's kind of interesting to hear that it has gone well for you with those kind of things on the menu.
Yeah, we're really excited. We have a lot of regulars that come down here, and you know, some of them just they just stop by the kitchen and say, you know, whatever you want to feed me tonight, whatever you got, because they have complete trust in us now.
Oh, now that's a nice thing. That's probably fairly rare.
Yeah, I mean, especially down here, you know, we try to get out and meet our guests, and we have, like I said, a lot of regulars that come in, and, you know, we know them by their first names. They buy the kitchen a round of beers, and, you know, it's good people down here.
That must be gratifying, you know, being in business just a year and a half.
It's really nice. It's really nice. And to have the following that we have, you know, down here it's amazing. And people being able to, you know, they're more adventurous eaters, I would say, down here than what we expected. We're not in Broad Ripple. We're not on Mass Ave. You know, we're in Greenwood, Indiana. People work hard down here, and, you know, and they spend their money wisely. And when they come in here, they see a value, and they appreciate the product that we put out.
Now, you also have a bar that opens somewhat later than the restaurant. So how did that come about, and how did this whole backroom area happen?
Well, we had this whole space back here, and we would only seat it on the weekends. And our front bar was always packed, and, you know, Mark looked at me, and he's like, we need a bigger bar. So we came up with the Bar Rev concept and put in a massive bar.
And has that been a hit, too?
It has been. It has been. It's two different environments. The back's kind of a little more dark, a little more hip. Music's a little louder, and it's a really neat feel back here.
So now, when it opened, people were talking about bringing, that you were bringing craft cocktails to Greenwood, you know, which didn't really have the whole craft cocktail scene that we might, you know, see, you know, in Indianapolis on Mass Ave or Fountain Square, that sort of thing. What was the reception to that?
You know, I'm mixed on the whole craft cocktail thing, and it's, you know, I don't know if it really works down here. You know, we've had success, but we think that moving forward, we want to go to more straight, you know, old fashions, you know, vodka tonics, stuff like that. We want it to be a bar. And the craft cocktail thing, for $12, you get two drinks for $24, and it's expensive because there's a lot of work that goes into it.
It is, and I think that maybe some of that emphasis on all the ingredients, I think maybe we're seeing a swing away from all those very complicated drinks. Now, you do stress whiskey, right? So yeah. Tell me a little bit about the whiskey list.
So we have everything. We have about 220 different whiskeys on our whiskey list, ranging from prices from $4 a shot up to $70 a shot.
Now, you mentioned that the back of the building might have a little bit of a history to it. You know, is it, tell me a little bit about that.
Well, we were told that it was an old mortuary at one point, and we installed $20,000 heaters. We have three of them, and the one that's in the back bar would never go above 65 degrees when we first opened. It would keep breaking. And then we had the alarm system, the motion sensors, triggered in the back bar a few times.
When nobody was here?
When nobody was here. So we don't know if we have a little ghost back here or...
Now, did you really come in when the alarm had gone off?
Mark came in, yes. And there was a police officer with him with his gun drawn because they believed somebody was in the building and nobody was here.
Do you think that there's something going on?
It's a little eerie when you're here by yourself at 11, 12 o'clock at night, or you come in and you're by yourself in this place. It's a little eerie sometimes.
That's kind of interesting too, right?
Yeah, it's really cool.
So what else, what are some of your hopes for the restaurant? Do you, you know, you have big plans for it? It seems like it has gone well in the first year.
Well, we're hoping that, you know, we installed a patio right after we did the back bar, and we didn't have the weather to cooperate with us last year, so this year we're hoping for a good patio season.
Now, is the is there separate menus? Is the back part of the restaurant, is it different? You know, I think you mentioned that it's almost like a separate restaurant.
Well, we do the same menu. If somebody comes in here and they want to order off the dinner menu, yes, of course, we will do that. But we do have, a smaller bar menu that we do go to whenever we close the restaurant.
So this part of the restaurant is open later then?
Yes, the back bar. I mean, we could be open till 2, 3 in the morning.
Does that happen?
It's happened before. We've been open late.
We've been talking to Reverie Chef and co-owner Danny Salgado. For more information on the restaurant, go to reveriegreenwood.com. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Thanks so much for tuning into our show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Kara Daffhorn of U Relish Farm in the historic Indianapolis City Market, Jacob Ebel of The Story Inn in Brown County, Indiana, and Danny Salgado, executive chef and co-owner at Reverie Restaurant in Greenwood. And thanks to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.